Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio today are Martin Arnold, our banking editor, and Caroline Binham, our financial regulation correspondent. Joining us down the line is Filippo Aluati, who's a credit analyst at Hermes. This week, we'll be looking at the acquisition by Santander of local rival Popular. Secondly, a look at the broader Eurozone banks field as the Santander Popular deal trials the new bail-in rules. And finally, latest developments in the foreign exchange scandal. First, though, to that Spanish consolidation story. Martin, we had a kind of regulatory blessed deal in Spain with Santander buying the troubled Popular. Interesting, obviously, as we'll come on to talk about from the point of view of, you know, the regulatory involvement in this, bailing in creditors and so on. But first of all, let's talk about what it means from the Santander point of view. This is the first big deal that Chairman Ana Botín has done in her 3 years as head of the bank.
Yeah, it's an important deal from Santander's point of view. The opportunity arose as Banco Popular entered what looked like a death spiral. It's this bank, it's the sixth biggest in Spain. It has a pretty strong small and medium-sized business lending operation, and it had come through the crisis, Popular, pretty well, and historically had a reputation for being a very conservative bank, but lost its way in the real estate bubble in Spain, came in late, aggressively lent a lot of money to property developers in Spain, and that has, it's never really recovered from that. It also did a pretty poor acquisition in the Galicia region of northern Spain, and so it's been trying to raise capital. It's raised more than 5 billion since the crisis of share issues. It raised 2.5 billion last year. Changed management, a new chairman came in this year, but it never really managed to solve this problem of this bad debts weighing down its balance sheet. So ultimately, regulators stepped in. The opportunity was there for Santander, which has been eyeing Popular for quite some years, as an opportunity to achieve its long-term ambition of bulking up in SME lending, small business lending, in its domestic market, Spain, where Santander is one of the biggest banks in the Eurozone, actually is quite underweight relatively in Spain. So this was a real opportunity, and it propels them to a clear number one market position, some 20% of the overall market in Spain for current accounts and lending, and 25% for SME lending. So a real coup for Ana Botín. Now, she's going to have to raise 7 billion euros through a rights issue at Santander to fund the deal. I mean, you only pay 1 euro for Banco Popular, but you've then got to raise 7 billion to cover the extra provisions that you take on the bad loans book to clean that up.
And so putting in the broader context of Santander's deal-making machine, which has been there for years, Ana Botín's father, Emilio, had done a string of acquisitions over his decades in charge of the bank. This is her first deal. Is it significant that it's a domestic Spanish deal rather than an international deal as her father might have done?
I mean, just to clarify, it's not her first deal. In the last 2.5-3 years that Ana Botín's been in charge, it's done some smaller deals, but this is the biggest one by far so far, and focusing on the domestic market. Emilio Botín, when, you know, from taking charge of Santander, was a pretty small bank when he took charge. He's built it up initially by doing a string of big Spanish mergers. Then, the last decade of his time in charge, he switched his focus very much to further flung markets like Latin America, like the US. He did deals in the Nordics regions, elsewhere in Europe. So, and obviously the UK coming in and buying Abbey National and adding a couple of other building societies that failed in the crisis. So his focus in the final decade or so was definitely further afield, whereas this is really coming back in. But it's also, I think, interesting that Emilio Butin had a real reputation for being an arch deal maker and always looking for a bargain, looking for a deal where he had an angle, where Santander had a particular angle, where they could, be quite clever in the way that they operated. Often coming in when he was the only bidder, squeezing on the price, has a real reputation for that. And I think the way that Ana Butin is showing that she's also inherited a lot of that skill. Because, as it turns out, in this process, this less than 24 hours that bidders were given to make their final offers for this bank by the regulators who'd taken control of it, Santander was the only one that made an offer. And as I say, bought it for €1. And a lot of the shareholders, and particularly the creditors who were the junior creditors who were wiped out part of this deal, are complaining, saying that Santander got it for a steal.
Well, we'll come on to talk about those creditors and the broader issue in our second topic, which is, what does this deal say about the new bail-in rules in Europe? I'm joined now by Filippo Aluati, who's a senior credit analyst at Hermes, to talk about this. So, Filippo, thanks very much for joining us. In your view, this deal, this Santander Popular deal, what does it do in terms of setting precedents for Eurozone bank regulation and the way forward in terms of resolving troubled banks?
Hi, yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, the Santander Popular deal, in our opinion, so create a precedent, and it could be viewed as a sort of blueprint in order to resolve a bank in a distressed situation.
So let's just be clear exactly what has happened here. Who was wiped out and who was not, and in what sense is that different from what went before?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, Banco Popular Español was in a difficult spot because they were already very close on the CET1 triggers as set by the European Central Bank.
The core capital ratio requirement.
The core capital ratio, exactly, yeah. And they also, to all mean and purpose, lost market access in the sense that they had to increase the provision on the bad loans because probably as many cases, in typical cases, so the value of the asset was overvalued. And so they had to increase the provision on these bad loans. And at the same time, they were making basically on a daily basis negative headline with some sort of deposit withdrawal by the retail clientele. And of course, so as we know in banking, what starts as a liquidity crisis end up in a insolvency situation, which seems to be the case as documented by the Financial Times in the days following the resolution on Banco Popular Español.
So, as you say, the bondholders therefore bore the brunt of this. Obviously, the equity has been wiped out, the junior bonds as well, and also these special COCO bonds, additional Tier 1 bonds, and Tier 2 bonds were wiped out.
Yeah, exactly. So what is happened, basically, all the subordinate bondholders, which in the case of Banco Popular amounted to €2 billion, were wiped out, converted to equity, but then instantaneously sold for a total consideration of €1 to Banco Santander. What is different from the Popular case versus the previous experience, like for example in Ireland with AB and Anglo-Irish, was there was in Ireland and also Bank of Ireland at the onset of the global financial crisis a differentiation within the different subordinate bondholders. In the case of Bank of Ireland, I remember the lower tier 2 were offered at least 10 cents in the euro, whereas the tier 1, I don't recall, it was just 2 or 3 cents. So there was a differentiation within the subordinate bondholder. In the case, both the tier 2, which has the intermediate subordinate, and the 81, which I say that the so-called COCO, or the bond which was absorbed losses almost at the same time as equity, were both wiped out, so zeroed, and then converted into Popular shares instantaneously quickly move on and transfer to Banco Santander for 1 euro.
And as we were saying, this applies the rules as they should be applied in Europe and therefore sets the precedent for other situations. And there are live situations in Italy, of course.
Exactly, and that's very important because resolution, both resolution theory and practice, to paraphrase Milton Friedman, is a bit like a Japanese garden. There is an apparent simplicity which conceals a sophisticated reality. And the sophisticated reality, for example, in the case of Italy, is that the Veneto Banca and Vicenza Banca, which are making headlines, are in different situation as Banco Popolare SM, because Banco Popolare had a problem with liquidity. So a solution needs to be found very readily. In the case of Vicenza and Veneto, they actually have access to liquidity through the so-called senior unsecured bonds guaranteed by the Italian Republic. And those bonds, in theory, are pari passu with the senior unsecured of Vicenza and Veneto, which has been sold to the wholesale market, and also pari passu with the depositor of those banks. So this is the complexity. It's difficult to say, okay, we had the example in Spain, now we should transfer this, transpose this example in Italy, because the technicalities are slightly different.
And Martin, you have an update on the latest on the Italian bank situation this morning.
Yeah, the finance minister, Mr. Padoan, has made an announcement saying that they are close to agreeing a deal to rescue these two banks in the Veneto region of Italy. And yeah, it's not going to be the same as the deal for Popular, because in this case, the government is expected to put money into these banks to rescue them. And it's just a question of whether they can also get some money alongside that from the private sector, which they need to get approval for the overall deal from Europe.
Very good. Well, we will watch that situation develop. In the meantime, Filippo Aluati from Hermes, thank you very much for joining us. Let's move on now to our third item for the day and a look at the latest developments in the foreign exchange trading scandal. Caroline, a couple of interesting moves here over the past few days.
Yeah, there have been two developments in the DOJ's criminal investigation into alleged forex rigging, and they're two separate strands, really. So last week, we heard that Stuart Scott, who was HSBC's former London-based head of currency trading, had been arrested in the UK. He lives just outside London, but at the behest of the US authorities. And Mr. Scott will, in fact, be contesting his extradition to the United States. Separately to that, we've heard that the three traders at the heart of the chat rooms that were dubbed the cartel have come to an arrangement with the Department of Justice whereby they won't fight extradition, so they'll be surrendering to the US authorities to face trial. And in exchange, they have agreed a security with the DOJ and the ability to come back to the UK pending trial. It should be said that in both cases, all the defendants deny wrongdoing.
Okay, and remind us of the context of this, because this is an affair that dates back many years now, but the DOJ investigations are ongoing. How many people have we seen brought to trial for this, in this whole affair, and has anyone gone to prison?
Well, a former trader at Barclays, Jason Katz, has pleaded guilty in again, another separate strand to the Forex investigation. I should explain that DOJ antitrust and fraud teams have both mounted separate investigations. They're related, but they're essentially looking at different allegations of rigging. So the fraud team were the ones that went after Mr. Scott and his boss, Mark Johnson, who was the one that was arrested at JFK last summer. And it's antitrust that have gone after the so-called cartel. That might be a technical point, but actually it might have a wider bearing when we're thinking about extradition battles, because a UK judge, who in the case of Mr. Scott will have to weigh whether to extradite him or not, will have to look at various considerations to come to that determination. And one of them is whether the alleged wrongdoing could be construed as a criminal offence in both countries, both the home nation and then the requesting nation.
So there's a long way to run with all of these cases. And simplistically, we're at an earlier stage than, for example, the rigging that went on in the interest rate benchmark, the LIBOR and related scandals, where we have seen quite a lot of individuals.
LIBOR, the LIBOR investigation, predated that of Forex by a good 3 or 4 years. So, yeah, that's in that sense, we're a little behind the curve on LIBOR when we're talking about Forex. And if we're looking at a potential trial of the so-called cartel, this will be the real first contested jury trial that we will see. Typically, DOJ cases, you often see a defendant plead guilty rather than want to run the risk of a contested trial, the uncertainty, and what is traditionally a much longer sentence for white-collar crime in the US than it is for in the UK.
We've got all of that to look forward to. Thank you, Caroline. That's it for this week. All that's left for me to do is to also thank Martin and our guest Filippo Aluati at Hermes. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Jyotsna Singh. Until next week, goodbye.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.